Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a board-certified veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. This show is a production of 8 Paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content. The Radio Pet Lady Network is brought to you in part by Spot Platinum, an allergy test to find out what in your dog's environment or diet may be causing his scratching or licking. Allergies for which Spot Platinum can make a USDA-approved serum, custom-tailored to your dog's specific needs to control his symptoms. Spot Platinum is a privately owned company that has done more than 500,000 allergy tests over 25 years. For more information, visit them on the web at www.vetallergy.com. This show is also brought to you by Meow Space, a clear ventilated enclosure that can be a one cat feeding space, a litter box station, or even a safe place to nap, designed so that only one cat with a unique access device can enter the see-through box. Meow Space is made in the USA to solve out-of-litter box problems and individualized feeding needs in multi-cat households. Big enough for large cats to do their business or small dogs to eat their food in peace, Meow Space benefits the whole family because it keeps dogs and small children out of the litter box, too. Go to meowspace.biz. That's meowspace.biz to see for yourself. I have a really important burning topic to discuss with you, Dr. Sean, and it's one that's going to touch on the excellence of the ingredients in some products you've made recently for dogs, particularly that have digestive or systemic challenges. So even though you don't like to self-promote and you don't like to say, oh, the Balance It food has these great ingredients, we'll just compare what you're doing with what other people are doing, and we won't say the names of their products. I think the thing that's hard for people to understand is why would a very specialty niche product made for dogs that have physical nutritional challenges, why does that cost so much more? So that's really the question, and it's a question that not enough consumers ask. If their vet puts them, as my vet has tried now three different times, to put me on a prescription diet that is supposed to address physiological issues of my dog, which might be short-term and might be long-term. New puppy, constant diarrhea, can't seem to digest anything, came from a malnourished, basically a puppy mill background, even though I thought I was buying from a good breeder. She wants me to use a food, the ingredients of which are unacceptable to me, and her opinion is, oh, but look, it solves the problem. And it solves the problem, what I think is a kind of high price. Then I go look at the Balance It foods, and I go, wow, that's even more expensive. But I know why. I know why a chicken byproduct meal and pork fat and brewer's rice are a whole lot cheaper than what you use. So having given you this platform on which to discuss the difference between applesauce and fresh apple pie tart-tartan with whipped cream, so to speak, let's talk about what it costs to make a quality dog food.
Okay. Well, I will raise my displeasure of being too self-promotional, so I'll keep it as general as possible.
But I can promote what you're doing because no one else is doing it. And okay, the veterinarians have long-standing relationships with now three different companies that make what are called prescription diets to address whether it's kidney issues or IBD or, whatever the issue are that it's supposed to, crystals and stones, which is one of the worst diet ideas ever, for reasons we could or could not discuss later. People need to understand that there now is a different option made by one of the few board-certified veterinary nutritionists in the whole world, that the whole world comes to your doorstep for advice, and you have made these, I guess they're called functional diets. I do think that because you're the only one doing it with the quality of ingredients that you're using, and the price is therefore higher, that people need to know that they are getting what they're paying for. It's not like, whoa, that's too costly. It's like, oh, great, good ingredients that will really solve my dog's problem. I will pay for that.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's talk about what costs more. And I think we'll start with ingredients, because I think that even before I went into industry from academia, I was surprised, because I think the perception is that sometimes ingredients that you think would be more expensive aren't, and some ingredients you think would be less expensive aren't. And so my best example of that is legumes versus chicken meal. So you see chicken meal all the time in pet foods, and chicken meal, as we've discussed in the past, is kind of like the rendered, fat removed, dried chicken, and, you know, leftover parts that you usually don't eat too much of is the general way that would be made. So you cut off the breast and things like that. It doesn't have to be, it could be the whole chicken, but that's usually how it's produced. And so because of its sourcing and because of how it's made, surprisingly, and there's different, of course, qualities. You know, you can have a higher ash chicken, so more bone is included and less or less bone and things like that. But on average, a chicken meal, relatively middle of the road, would be equivalent or even a little less expensive than a dried legume, peas or lentils or things like that on the market. And I think that's surprising to folks. I don't think that they anticipate that. And so when you see a product that uses and avoids grains that we heavily subsidize, at least in the United States, like corn,
right?
The corn price is really very misleading. It's not really capturing the real cost of that. And if there's not heavy subsidies on growing lentils or black beans or kidney beans or
chickpeas,
there's a bigger divergence than really there should be in the cost of those products. And you can see that in your own experience. I mean, there's a reason why, and I always find this really interesting. If you look there, and we'll get a little off topic, but I think it'll help us understand this.
Good.
There's, you know, you go and buy now, and you can go in the chip aisle, and, you know, like tortilla chips or some type of snack chips, and you see all these that say lentil chip or black bean chip. But if you look at the ingredient declaration, the ingredient list, it's not the only ingredient. It's still a corn chip, or it's still a potato chip.
Right.
And it's mostly using that, and then it has a smattering of it, either to have visible inclusion, as you would refer to it, you know, little specks of brown, but most of it is still actually corn. And the reason for that is because it's just really expensive. And if you were to have a completely lentil-based chip and a corn chip, the cost would be so different that I think it'd be very hard to be competitive. And so if you then translate that to a, let's say, grain-free product, pet food, you're not getting the normal benefit that you would expect or hope to on a cost basis by using expensive and less common, you know, legumes as your base. You're actually causing it to be more expensive. There's nothing to cheapen it, if you will. And I don't really want to say that corn is cheap, meaning that the connotation of that it's not something that can be wholesome and be used for energy and all that. But I just mean from something that makes it less expensive, because that's what carbohydrates are used for. They're used in pet food to make the food less expensive. Well, if all of a sudden you reach for a carbohydrate-rich food or a legume and use that exclusively, like we do in, you know, one of our two dry foods, you don't get any benefit from that, and it just makes it more expensive. Now, someone will say, well, that's
you mean
also
you mean you don't get a cost benefit, but you get a nutritional benefit.
Oh, absolutely. There's a reason we're picking. We want it to be low carb. We want it to have a lower glycemic index. We want to have it be higher fiber. We want to avoid grains. There's all sorts of reasons for food allergy that we're using it, but it doesn't make the food cheaper. It doesn't make it less expensive to produce. It actually hurts you, if you will. And that then has consequences. Now, someone would say, well, it's all about volume. Well, even if I were at a much bigger company, which I have been in the past, you don't get that much volume discount. There isn't that enough that it's going to be, you know, a magnitude that would explain the difference in cost. And so the cost difference really does drive is by raw material. Well, then you add other things, which is you're not going to use meals. So, you know, if you avoid meals as a predominant main ingredient, so if you're using, you know, catfish, not catfish meal exclusively, or you're using pork instead of pork meal like we do, then you're using those as the first two ingredients, that increases your cost, both from a logistics perspective, because you've got to either, you got to keep it cool. You can't let it go bad. You can't use it off off season. And, you know, I always find it interesting for pork, for example, and not to say that a lot of people go to McDonald's, but, you know, both at McDonald's and then where was I recently? Oh, I was someplace where they were advertising carnitas or back or something like that at some Mexican place. There was a chain. And, you know, the McRib is a classic example of that. The McRib, which is the pork-based product at McDonald's, is not available year round. It sells very well for them, my understanding. And the reason for that is they can't make enough money because pork only becomes cheap enough certain times of the year.
Wow.
And I don't know what drives the seasonality or when it's going to be cheap enough, but I had a colleague whose husband actually worked for the company who made those McRibs, and they would only make them when the pork prices were such that it was economical
right.
for enough of a margin. Well, so when you pick products that have to be maintained, you know, fresh,
as if they're good,
dehydrated.
Good, clean food. Let me just back up for a minute about meal, because I want to tell you that a year or however long ago it was we started this show, I had very strong opinions based on not research as deep as yours, having been immersed in the industry from every angle for so long, but certainly from popular research and also the description of what meal is. And if I recall correctly, you were not willing to say negative things about a protein meal in a dog food, chicken
That's
meal,
correct.
Right? And maybe you still aren't. However, as you just described it, and we also understand the whole socioeconomic issue that cheaper, less expensive ingredients need to be used to make some affordable products for people who can only afford them. And we don't want to take those products off the shelf or make...
Or more importantly, we don't want to allow only rich people to be able to...
That's right. That's absolutely right. Or food fanatics, if you want to call me that in a way. You know, like, you know, we don't use GMO stuff in my house. We try to use organic dairy. We try to not use dairy that has any growth hormones in it. Things like that. But if, in fact... To make a meal, and there are a couple of pet food companies that strongly say, we don't use any meal. Meal, as I understand it, and you talked about refrigerating or keeping clean the pork or the catfish, meal can use, I mean, absolutely, I've read this in too many places to know otherwise, can use meat, not really the breast meat or the thigh meat or the body meat, but the carcass, the entrails, the feet, the head, the whatever the parts are that can be rendered into meal. It can use things that are going bad, that are bad. They can use animals out in the feedlot that have died.
Yeah, we've had long discussions of this, and I think where I would focus our efforts is that sometimes the things that are very much present in meals, so if we talk about a byproduct meal, there can be ingredients that you would actually see as more wholesome. You know, let's say it's liver-based and it's using liver. There's lots of trace minerals and vitamins in liver that we lose when we don't use that. I mean,
right.
We've talked in the past about, you know, the reasons you have to fortify homemade food is because we exsanguinate, we remove
right.
blood, we eviscerate, we remove internal organs, you know, we debone. Well, you know, all of those things, bone and certain types of internal organs that are present in meals actually can make it more nutritious, meaning that it has, and when we use the definition of essential nutrients and the concentration of those essential nutrients. Where I think the concern comes in is your point is quality. You know, what is it being derived from? Is it, you know, an animal that, you know, has not been the most healthful? Is it, you know, parts of the animal that, you know, we say, oh, great if it's liver and bone, but maybe if it's, you know, lung, I don't like it as much, or trachea.
Well, what if I don't like that it's been sitting in a tractor trailer in the heat, and that's allowed by law? So it's
right.
it's going
so
then, bad
right,
in a
right,
big
so
fat way.
Right,
yeah.
So rancidity becomes a concern, and you know, and how do you address for stabilizing the fat? And you know, and a lot of times our meals being stabilized with, you know, natural preservatives or artificial preservatives, and the artificial preservatives bring their own history to the table. But I think going back to it, when you make the choice to use these inclusion, and we use in our one of our foods, catfish is the first ingredient, but the second ingredient is catfish meal, and we specifically selected that because we wanted a natural source of glucosamine chondroitin sulfate because of the joint benefits that can bestow
on.
And so there are times where you might pick or reach for something, but by picking and making it the first ingredient on something that also these are products that don't have a laundry list, meaning they don't have 20 ingredients. And why is that important? Because if you have 20 ingredients, you can stack the ingredient order in your favor by putting everything in equal amounts so that your inclusion level, we've talked about this before, of your, you know, catfish or your pork can be much lower because you can distribute it. So, for example, if you have 20 ingredients and they're all at 5%, and obviously that's oversimplification,
right.
Let's say that to add up to 100%, you can pick any of those 20 ingredients and put it as the first of your list.
Right.
Whereas if you only have two or three or four ingredients, your inclusion level to have that at the top has to be 33% or 25%.
Right.
You know, in our catfish product, it's more than half of it is catfish. Well, that's an expensive ingredient,
yes,
especially if you're drying out. And so that just leads to more costs, and volume doesn't help you. Volume doesn't help you that much. And so the other area, which I think people don't realize, is that, you know, if you can distribute your testing in your production run, there is volume benefits. So it's an ideal situation if a manufacturer could make one kibble year round, all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That would be optimal, because every time you switch over to a different kibble, you have to change out, you have to, you know, in our case, you have to clean the entire line because you don't want to have any cross contamination.
Right.
You know, that costs money. So we, for example, have to pay for the downtime of the entire plant to be cleaned and the labor that it takes to clean it before they run our products. And so if you can then run more products because you're ordering more, you can distribute that cleaning time,
right,
and downtime across more products. So there's some definite volume there that you lose, as well as testing. So, you know, we test for all these key nutrients to make sure we're hitting our target, and we'll reject production if there's a miss. And so that testing costs a lot. Each of our products, when we run it, it's in the neighborhood, I haven't looked recently, but it's about $1,000 to $1,500 of testing in a third-party,
wow,
laboratory. That if you're doing smaller runs, that actually adds up to your overall cost. Whereas if you're doing tons and tons and tons, even though we do tons and tons,
right,
but, you know, tens of tons or 20s,
right,
of tons or whatever the number may be, you can distribute that testing cost over a larger batch or run. And then there's also just the aspect of distribution. You know, some of these companies have their own distribution companies, so they're not having to pay a common carrier to ship directly,
right,
to the end consumer. They already have a truck that goes to every vet clinic, let's say, or every retailer.
They do.
And that gives them some huge costs. You know, when I look at our foods and you look at the price of it, I'm trying to give a good estimate of that. A third to a quarter of the price is just shipping costs.
Oh, golly. This is something I heard happened when the price of gas went up, that all these companies, from FedEx to individual companies, trucking companies, all these fuel surcharges, and when the price dropped down to half of that, they not only never took them away, they even made more of them. So
there's never the fuel credit. You never see that on anything.
Never. I mean, we have people that come down just to do a, you know, labor at the house, a fuel surcharge. Hey, guys, we all see the price of gas is actually maintained very low compared to other countries. It's a half or a third of what people are paying in Europe. And that's just because of whatever we've tried to do, I think, sociopolitically. I don't know. But I certainly was also told, in helping somebody who had an idea for a company, that it didn't matter how light or how heavy what you were shipping was, it was the volume. So that all these big carriers, in your case, the things are heavy, but they're also big and they have volume, that they're charging on how much of the truck it uses up, how much space it takes.
Right. It doesn't go linear. That's another,
right,
interesting aspect, is that, you know, if I ship, you know, you think of it in the way that the post office mostly treats it, but not exactly. The more you weight you ship, the more it's going to cost you. But if you look, it's still not linear. Linear meaning that if it's twice as heavy, it's twice as expensive. It's actually more of a exponent, and it's not an exponent that's one that hurts you. It actually helps you the more you send out. So when we send out a pallet worth of product to one of our places that distributes for us, it might weigh 1,000 pounds, let's say. It may only cost $500. I'm just making this number up, right?
Right.
Whereas if I were to send out 1,000 bottles, that same amount might cost me $10,000 to ship.
Whoa. So it does matter what the container is.
And yes, and if it, how many different locations it's going to. And so, you know, if you can have a centralized location where you're sending it to a retailer, and we'll call all retailers, that might be the veterinary hospital that's,
right,
retailing it, that might be the retailer, you know, it's very efficient For it to go to that one location, because a truck stops there, it all goes there, and then lots of different people in the surrounding area goes to it and does that, what they call the last mile. And the last mile
is yeah.
the most expensive. Whereas if you have to have it delivered directly to the door, your costs are, you know, it could be 10 times as much as it would otherwise cost.
So these are things that really matter and add to the price, but someone has to understand the difference between buying a kind of mass market, off the shelf, one size fits all, and don't look too closely at how well the zipper's put in, if you want to just call it a garment rather than the ingredient deck label on a prescription pet food, or something which is made in smaller, more handcrafted type of batches. I mean, that's a word that's sort of bandied around. It's a bit silly because no one's sitting there making kibble by hand. It's not like hand rolled pasta, but it is certainly more more boutique-y. I mean, the ingredient, just the catfish alone is not a product which is out in the marketplace. I mean, it's an amazingly cool product. There are dogs with some serious protein allergies, and there's not much they can eat. And to have created a food that uses a food source that's high in protein and also has the omega-3s and other health benefits.
Well, it's a Mediterranean diet. I mean, I don't ever refer to it as that, but, you know, it's, you hear all this thing lately of, Mediterranean diet, you know, rich in beans, rich in fish oils, rich in fish. That's what this is, low in carbohydrate. It has all the bells and whistles you possibly could put into one food. I mean, regardless, I said this to someone, and I feel a little bit self-serving, but I'll say it is the best food that particular food I could ever make. At least with the technology we have. And that's saying something. I've made a lot of different foods.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the days of Karma, when you made the first high protein, like super duper.
Well, that's an organic food or Evo. And I've made some great foods and nothing to take away from them. I think they're great. But when you go step back and go, what can I do, you know, that's really novel in ingredients and get the right profile for, you know, these anti-inflammatory, I put it all into that product. And how can I do the testing for it? And, you know, let me not use palatants that might come from an animal. I put everything I possibly can into that. But that also doesn't translate to the one thing I didn't put in is how can I make it cheap? And I find that fascinating, and I find it fascinating in the world we live in. Where is that balancing point, if you will? You know, the brand name is Balance It, but where is that balancing point where your price point becomes something that's perceived as too high, and the value for that is not great enough? And I think there's a cognitive dissonance, is I think the fancy word, where I think that people think that they can get all the bells and whistles in a bag that's 40 pounds for $20. And that's physically impossible. Compromises have to be made. And if you want all the bells and whistles and for them to truly be there, even if you were a big producer in these big companies that make some of those fancy foods, they're going to be expensive. There's just no way around it. And the greatest worry I have is when I see a food that has, quote, all these bells and whistles, but is selling at a price point that is far below what you could be made for. And I went through this experience when I was at Natura. We had a competitive product that had this ingredient declaration that had all these just wonderful ingredients. And we went through and spent probably a week or two trying to rebuild it, you know, reverse engineer
yes.
with all the pricing. And we weren't, you know, Purina or Mars, but we had good pricing and good volume.
Yeah.
And we couldn't buy the raw material, not talking about make it, package it, ship it. We couldn't buy the raw materials no matter how we manipulated the declaration, you know, with all the tricks that we were talking about earlier, and make that product, which then told me that something was not kosher, if you will.
Yes. Absolutely. And that's the thing that I think is one of the values of this show, is to have people have a sharper eye, take things with a grain of salt, take things with, I don't know, a bit of cynicism. Because on the one hand, people don't read the ingredients list at all when they get something that's a prescription diet. They're anxious that their pet has some sort of illness or problem. Oh my God, this is the solution. Great. And when I was told that, for example, with this puppy, I was like, she says, you're not going to like to hear this, but this is what you should feed. And I was like, I don't like to hear that you think I should feed this dog pork fat and brewer's rice with a ton of chemicals for the rest of her life. Clearly, you mean only short term until her gut learns to actually digest, which is one of the things that Lucy Postens has said about the Honest Kitchen. Many dogs' guts have gone to sleep. The bacteria are dead, dormant. They're not there. They can't digest food. They've just been given too much of highly, highly, highly processed carbohydrates and not much else. And she said, oh, no, many people stay on this diet forever because their dog absolutely needs it. And I think that there is a misconception, whether it's German Shepherd dogs or English Bulldogs, many breeds that have tremendously high digestive challenges, a misperception by people that you have to give only these ingredients that, while the price is a bit high, actually the ingredients are unbelievably cheap. And so that's just pure profit, or it's spent on the distribution or the advertising. And they don't understand they could embrace quality ingredients that address the issues of a dog with digestive problems.
Yeah, and I'm not anti other therapeutic companies. As you know, I recommend them regularly, and I'm supporters, and I think they do a great job. And I think, to your point, you know, yes, there's money spent in advertising, they have volume benefits and all that. But one of the things that I think we've talked about in the past, they do support research. And, you know, a lot of companies that are, I don't want to say that they're anti-big companies, are the first companies that line up to benefit from the research that the big companies have done. And I've always found that a little disingenuous, you know, and I think it's unfortunate, because if you go back and look at a lot of what we know, and we've talked about this a number of years ago, what we know about dog and cat nutrition, a lot of it would not exist had it not been for the generosity, I think is the right word, of the larger companies. Now, you could say it's self-serving because they needed to know it themselves, but I think we need to remember that they could try to retain that as proprietary information and not share it. And a lot of times they do share that information with others, which then benefits other companies and ultimately, most importantly in my mind, benefits dogs and cats. So I don't want to beat up on them too much.
I don't want to beat up. I don't want to beat up on those companies for any number of reasons. Those medicinal diets, I believe strongly, are meant to be used as if they were medicine. You wouldn't put a dog on antibiotics forever or steroids forever. It's to be used at the time of a flare-up or an intense problem. But then you need to find out what is the underlying problem and solve the problem. Every dog should be able to eat food, lots of Sure. different kinds of food. So the idea that there are so many dogs that can only live on this highly intensely controlled ingredient list that the people are not looking at because for fear of it, and then they're told, oh my God, you might get loose stool, as if that were some death
sure.
sentence.
And there are definitely medical conditions that are something that has to be managed lifelong. There's no two ways around it, and there aren't other alternatives. And let's talk, and we've talked about this before, if I were trying to make my life easy, the best way is to use exactly what you're discussing, because if you can split out, and we've talked this, make things as clean or as pure as possible, then it's a lot easier to consistently formulate. Adding natural ingredients adds variability
right.
and risk, and greater risk that you're going to have product that will be out of specification. And I think when we launched the dry foods, I talked about this. So we use an ingredient which we know in one of the foods is the main source of phosphorus when we're trying to control phosphorus in it, the overall diet. And we actually, before we utilize it, we have to test it, because we have to reject it if the phosphorus goes out of a range, because we know if we then make the food with it,
right.
it becomes very problematic. Well, if you can use very fractionated, very processed ingredients, their purity becomes much greater. You have something that's just starch, something that's just fat, something that's just protein,
right.
and then lots of vitamins and minerals. Well, then you've eliminated the variability and the risk that something is not going to be exactly where you want it in these very highly controlled diets that have to be controlled to manage the particular disease. And so it makes it easier and more consistent to use more highly processed ingredients. And at times it also helps with cost, which we talked about. But it also can't lose sight of the fact that as you use more natural foods, there is more seasonality, more variability in those ingredients when they're whole and the way that they came from nature. Now, in healthy animals, you're absolutely can manage through that and can deal with fluctuations to a certain extent. But when you're really narrowly and you say, I want to control calcium within, you know, 10% of plus or minus, or you want to control phosphorus, or you want to control, you know, fat or whatever the nutrient is for these health conditions, that makes it a lot easier if you don't use things that are more wholesome or natural or however you want to phrase
it. Okay, so that all sounds really good, like to the veterinarian listening and to those of you out there. I love you all and I love what you do for pets. But you have to understand that if we open our brains to common sense, we cannot breed and raise and manage dogs that cannot eat food. And what we do by not being able to accept a little diarrhea, my friends, or a little loose stool, is we say, I only want hard stool. And I am sick to death, Dr. Sean, of vets and a pet food industry that seems to think that what comes out the hind end should dictate what goes in the front end. And we wouldn't do it with our baby humans. We wouldn't do it with our toddlers. Hey, God, the kid ate, you know, pureed squash for the first time. Ew, gross diapers. But you know what? His body, the human little person's body, is learning to digest a fresh vegetable. Wow, what a shocking idea. Our dogs need to have variety in their diet because from real, natural food sources, they get much more bioavailability of the ingredients. They get the fun.
Diverse gut flora.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You want to know, I want to do a show with you about these claims that kibble causes cancer, which is one of the most bizarre, insane things, ideas that's floating around the world that people latch onto. It's goofy, but I will tell you that if you never feed... If you were to never feed yourself or your children, your human ones, any real ingredient, and everything was this tightly controlled, measured in a laboratory by people wearing white hats and white shoes and white outfits, you would wind up down the road with humans that had a lot of other compromises. And, you know, you can go in, oh, I want to solve the kidney problem with the phosphorus. But honestly, if you were to feed that dry food that's sold at the vets, what's called a renal control or maintenance diet, you are going to cause other problems, guaranteed. And it is possible to do it by even home feeding with a nutritional supplement and some testing and some adding of a phosphate binder or whatever it may be. I think that anyone listening to this show is devoted enough to their pets, or if you're vets you're devoted enough to your clients and to your patients to understand that we have to use common sense and logic. We are not trying to turn out robotic guts that only can take in robotic ingredients to turn out robotic poo. I just think it's really...
You really raise an interesting point. I was in Indianapolis very recently, so there's an annual meeting, which I think I've talked to them before, where all the specialists come together, specifically internal medicine, oncology, cardiology, nutrition, neurologists, and we have all these scientific presentations, and then there's sometimes review. And one of the interesting presentations, or maybe one of the most interesting presentations, was a summary of 15 years, of research by Royal Canin, so that's one of the divisions of Mars, looking at the different things they could do with foods to improve stool quality, and went through the process. And it was with a focus on large breed dogs, where they saw that the same food in a large breed dog given to them would result in a stool quality that wasn't as ideal. And you touched upon it. There's such a focus on that. And what was fascinating is that some of the things nutritionally that we would want to do were not the things that optimized stool quality. And so it really begs the question of, you know, what is driving the decisions? Well, I can tell you that the number one complaint when we would survey when I was at Natura of when people would call in was if there was any stool quality concerns. And we tested everything in our own kennel. And one of the main focuses of having that kennel and why we tested it was not just for palatability, which was very important, but was for stool quality. We did so much stool quality work. And it was, if you would reject decisions that you would otherwise accept solely on the basis as if the stool quality wasn't acceptable. And I've said it before, it's hard to take away the fact that people have to intimately touch and be involved with their pet's feces, even far more than their own. And so the quality of it and the consistency of it is still a very, very important part of it. And I don't know how we get around that. And I do think it's an interesting discussion because not everything you do to improve stool quality is something that improves overall performance or makes it more optimal nutrition.
That I would totally agree with. We're going to wrap up this show on the thought that those of you that care enough about what goes into your pet food and what goes into your pet's mouth, might be willing to consider that what comes out the other end should not be your main focus. I mean, get a stand-up scooping thing. Get a thicker bag to pick it up with. There's a million different products for picking up poo. You don't have to worry about it getting gushy on your hands. And then there's always soap and water. Now, those of you who live in urban areas, it's a little more of a challenge, but the dog's already stressed by living in an urban area. Don't you think he deserves some, like, real food while he's living in this artificial environment? I think it's really important that we just knock ourselves up the side of the head and go, okay, stool quality, not really the thing I want to focus on.
Or not the only thing, maybe.
Right, but certainly in terms of nutrition, it really needs to be what's in it, how it goes in their body, and what it's doing for them while it's in there. Next show, Dr. Sean and I, he doesn't know this, but I want to talk about this claim that I've now seen again this past week. Pet food causes cancer. Dry food causes cancer. Can you believe it? Well, personally, I don't believe it, not an iota of it. So I'm dying in the next show to find out what Dr. Sean thinks about that, what drives that claim, and whether there's any science that could, even a shred of science that could be behind it. In the meantime, go to balanceit.com. Check out all the ways you could feed your own dog at home with supplementation that would give them a completely balanced diet. And look at the two specialty dried foods that Balance It has made. Dr. Sean won't tell you to look at them, but I'm telling you to, because if you have one of those dogs where you really cannot introduce frozen broccoli nuggets, you might really want to consider some of these beautifully created foods. Pay $5 more and understand, sadly, it's probably going to FedEx or UPS, but oh well. Not going to Dr. Sean, by the way. You know, 25% is going to the pocket of someone that owns a trucking company. But there you go. That's the reality of modern commerce.
Well, I don't like the promotion, but thank you for it.
It's my pleasure. Dr. Sean, we will talk again very soon about cancer in dog food. Do those two things actually have anything to do with each other? Thank you all for listening. Take care of your pets. Bye for now. Thanks for listening. The Radio Pet Lady Network is brought to you in part by Spot Platinum, an allergy test for which elements in your dog's environment or diet may be causing his scratching or licking. He may have allergies that Spot Platinum can determine and for which they can make a USDA-approved serum custom-tailored to your dog's specific needs to control his symptoms. Spot Platinum is a privately owned company that has done more than 500,000 allergy tests over 25 years. For more information, visit them on the web at vetallergy.com. Support for the show also comes from VaxaCheck, a simple test done right in your vet's office to discover whether your dog or puppy is protected from the deadly core diseases or needs revaccination. Shelters can use VaxaCheck on new arrivals to separate healthy dogs from unprotected ones and avoid unnecessarily over-vaccinating dogs. VaxaCheck, for your dog's safety and your peace of mind. And VaxaCheck for cats is coming soon.